Hey, welcome to episode 370 of the Fantastic Forecast. I'm David Elliott, and I wonder why they don't make comic books about dancing. Today, Fantastic Four, 370 from November 1992. Forever Evil by Tom DeFalco and Paul Ryan. So the Infinity War crossovers continue, and now the Evil Magus has the Infinity Gauntlet, a big yellow glove with five powerful Infinity Gems that give him unimaginable power. But someone forgot to tell Magus that the whole one-glove look went out of style in the 1980s. But Magus, he's pretty badass. Magus don't care. Magus don't give a shit. He just wears what he wants, and he revels in his power, saying that he has attained the pinnacle of ultimate power. I thought the pinnacle of ultimate power was having your own podcast. Boy, was I wrong. He's got his enemy Adam Warlock hung up on some kind of living tree, not Groot, like some kind of orange Christ-like figure. Magus is bragging about how he can turn the universe into a living nightmare. Back with the heroes in the battle with the evil doppelgangers, the Human Torch is just letting the bad guys have it with his flames, burning them all to hell. Ben is like, "Are you crazy? You can't go flash frying them. We're supposed to be the good guys." Johnny says he has no choice. They're only mindless slugs anyway. Ben looks around and doesn't see Sue anywhere, and wonders where she slipped off to. Well, she has turned invisible, so it does make her hard to see. Now she's roaming around Magus's sprawling citadel, and she comes across Thanos fighting with his evil doppelganger, which really, they're both pretty evil, so I'll call it Thanos's doppelganger. One Thanos has two gloves, the other Thanos is wearing only one glove. But Thanos, he's pretty badass. Thanos don't care. Thanos don't give a shit. He just wears what he wants. So Sue's standing there watching. She has no idea which Thanos to help out. How about neither of them? Back with the other heroes, the Thing is busy fighting with the Thor and the Hulk doppelgangers. He sees Johnny get blown out of the sky by the evil Storm, and then suddenly, Ben can't breathe. He's being suffocated by a force field from the evil Sue Richards. She's finally making her appearance. And surprisingly, she's dressed like the regular Sue, not showing any cleavage. Ben goes over and grabs her neck and starts choking her, but decides he can't kill her, not even if she's an evil slug creature. But Johnny comes over, and he's got no problem in frying up an evil doppelganger of his sister. Ben is really concerned about these evil doppelgangers. Who knew he was such a pussy? Back inside, Sue is secretly using invisible force fields to try to help the Thanos that she thinks is the real Thanos beat the imposter. When Thanos zaps the other Thanos, she adds an extra push with a force field ramming the doppelganger into the wall. And with one Thanos on the floor, about to be destroyed by the other Thanos, Sue thinks for a second about stopping this brutal beating, but she decides, nah, fuck it. Let them beat the shit out of each other. She's gonna leave the room and go looking for Magus. She heads down a hall, down a corner, turns a corner, and finds a collection of real superheroes held in suspended animation. Well, real heroes and Darkhawk. There's Iron Man, Black Widow, Daredevil, Namorita, and her husband, Reed. She rams the status field with a force field and frees everyone. She helps Reed down and fills him in on everything that's going on. Just then, an image of Magus's head pops up in the room and asks Reed if he was unhappy with the accommodations. The status field doesn't seem so bad. I've stayed in some quality inns that were worse. Reed's like, whoa, that's no hologram. That's an actual physical manifestation of his head. So Sue tries to hit it with some sharp pointy force field knives, but Magus just laughs it off. Back with the real Magus, he snaps his fingers and all the heroes and Galactus, they were fighting the doppelgangers, they're now held in this big yellow circle, which Magus calls his trophy room. But then, the real Thanos shows up, and Magus tells him not to fuck with him. He's totally, you know, like a god. He orders Thanos to bow down before him, and Thanos struggles against Magus's power, but he manages to get close enough to sock Magus in the face, and then Magus punches him back. So since he was busy with Thanos and not paying attention, Magus doesn't notice Warlock get off that tree thing and sneak up behind him, and he grabs the Infinity Gauntlet on Magus's left hand. Warlock once held the Infinity Gauntlet, so the powerful glove reacts to his touch, too. What follows is a battle of wills as they stand there struggling to gain control over the Infinity Gauntlet. Thanos decides to get the hell out of there, and right after, there's a big explosion. When the smoke clears, Warlock and Magus are gone, and Galactus, Thanos, and all the heroes are floating in space, grabbing hold of asteroids and wondering what the hell happened. Johnny finds Ben, and he's boasting that the Fantastic Four kicked Magus' ass, which they did not. Ben thinks Johnny's sounding like a crazy bloodthirsty vigilante, and Johnny says, "Back off, Ben. It's the 90s. "Yeah, that's right. All Johnny needs now is a big giant gun and some shoulder pads, and he'd be right at home in the 90s. Reed, meanwhile, notices that Sue seems more aggressive and colder, and we know he likes his ladies docile and hot. Suddenly, there's this burst of colored light, like they're in a Skittles commercial. Everything seems distorted, and everyone hangs on for their lives. Reed thinks Magus and Warlock have distorted reality, but suddenly, Galactus zaps everyone back into his ship, and he hightails it away from the distortion area. Doctor Strange wonders if they can outrun the blast, but Galactus replies that they can't. It'll catch up to them eventually, destroying them all, and the universe. Thanks, Magus and Warlock. The blast catches up to the ship, and it starts to break apart. Reed and Sue hold on to each other, thinking that they're at the end of their lives. But then suddenly, boing, they're all teleported back to Earth, and the FF are returned to Four Fantastic Freedoms Plaza, whatever. They figured that Warlock must have won the fight with Magus, and Reed doesn't like being left out of the loop, and he asks, "What happened to our roof?" Sue tells him that the evil doppelganger blew it up. "Thanks, evil Reed doppelganger." And then Sue gets all pissy with Reed, calling him their weak link, and saying he was useless during their battle with Magus and the doppelgangers, which is true. But it's not his fault. Infinity War was not a Fantastic Four-based story. She asks, "Where was all your great scientific knowledge when we needed it most?" And she storms off. Johnny says he's going to follow his sister's lead, only without insulting anyone, and he flies off. He starts to think that he still wants to quit the team, but now is not the best time to make this announcement. Ben is wondering what the hell's going on with Johnny and Sue, and a buzzer goes off, announcing they have a visitor. Ben goes to check, and he says, "Oh no." Reed is walking down the hall, questioning his ability to lead the team, and realizing that Sue can get along just fine without him. Maybe Mr. Fantastic isn't so fantastic anymore. Maybe he never was, he says. You know, he's got the powers of the elongated man, so yeah, he never really was all that fantastic. He walks in and finds his wife playing with Franklin, and then Ben runs in with their visitor. It's Puppet Master, and we learn that Alicia has been kidnapped. Oh shit, not again. Meanwhile, in orbit over Earth, a ship arrives carrying Payobok the Power Scroll and Devos the Devastator. I prefer to call them Payobok the Pussy Scroll and Devos the Dorkinator. They're all happy and filled with joy, planning to destroy the Fantastic Four, using the help of someone who knows the FF very well, Johnny's wife, Lijah the Scroll. And that's it for this issue. Coming next time, the Fantastic Four try to find Alicia, Sharon shows up looking for a lunch date with Ben, and she gets a new costume with, guess what? Yes, giant shoulder pads. Devos and Payobok come to Earth and attack Johnny, bringing Lijah with them. And guess what she's wearing? If you guessed an outfit with big shoulder pads, give yourself a cookie. And Sue gets a new outfit as well. And surprisingly, it lacks shoulder pads. In fact, it lacks a lot of everything. Whoa. I just want to let you know you can download other episodes of this podcast to iTunes or find them all at www.podcastff.podbean.com. I have a blog where you can see my favorite panels from each issue of the Fantastic Four at www.podcastff.blogspot.com. And if you have any questions about the Fantastic Four, about this podcast, or if you need relationship advice, you can email me at podcastff@gmail.com. So long, kids. This podcast is not over. I still got some extra business to get out of the way. Namely, the Fantastic Four annual from 1992. And so, welcome to Fantastic Forecast, episode 370, part 2. Today, Fantastic Four annual 25 from 1992. Twice Upon a Time by Mark Gruenwald. and Herb Trimpe. So once again, it's the early 1990s, where Marvel was doing the thing where all the annuals were connected in a series of four-part crossovers. This FF annual is part three of a story called Citizen Kang, which started in the Captain America and the Thor annuals and picks up here with the FF annual as the Fantastic Four get involved. So at this time, Rob Liefeld was super popular and Herb Trimpe, was not. So the powers that be told Trimpe, "Hey Herb, why don't you draw more like that Rob Liefeld guy?" And boy, oh boy, does he ever draw like Rob Liefeld. He draws the shit out of this comic. It's hilariously terrible. I would recommend you buy this comic and read it just to see the artwork. It is nightmarish. Oh, poor Herb Trimpe. So the story begins with the Human Torch flying over the city of New York. When he sees an FF flare shooting out of a nearby alley, he goes to see what it is and he finds Dr. Druid, who tells Johnny he needs to enlist the Fantastic Four's help to aid him against Kang. Johnny wonders why Dr. Druid didn't call the Avengers, and I'm wondering why Dr. Druid didn't just go to Fantastic Four headquarters instead of lurking around in a dark alley. Just then, this woman pops up with big black hair, and she says that she just wanted to say hello to Johnny. It's clear that Dr. Druid and her are working together. Johnny kind of recognizes her, and Druid tells her, "Woman, I told you to stay out of sight and let me present the case against Kang myself." She tries to mind control Johnny, but Druid stops her, and he casts a spell to disrupt the illusion that she has so Johnny can see her true face. And basically, she looks the same, only with blonde hair now. And we learn that this woman is Nebula. You know, isn't she supposed to be blue? Dr. Druid says that he likes to call her the Temptress, insinuating that Nebula isn't her real name. Is this not the Blue Nebula, daughter of Thanos? I remember Dr. Druid fell under her spell for a while back when he was briefly a member of the Avengers in the 1980s. This is the first time I've ever read this comic, and the first time I ever realized that the Blue Nebula, daughter of Thanos, who first appeared in the Avengers in the mid-1980s, is different from the Blue Nebula, the time-traveling chick, who first appeared in the Avengers in the late 1980s. How fucking confusing is that? I just googled this Nebula, and her real name is Ravonna Renslayer, one of Kang's ex-girlfriends, who really first appeared back in Avengers issue 23. Just then, the rest of the Fantastic Four show up, wondering what the hell is going on. Dr. Druid says to Reed that he's long hoped to make his acquaintance, and introduces himself as Anthony Druid. So obviously this takes place before the Infinity War, when they were interacting with each other as well. Reed says he's heard of him, and Druid says he has a story to tell. It starts back when Druid was a member of the Avengers, and as I mentioned, Nebula gained control over Dr. Druid's mind, and using Dr. Druid's powers, she was able to control the entire Avengers. Her big plan was to steal technology from the Council of Cross-Time Kangs, but in the end, she got sucked into a temporal maelstrom and pulled Dr. Druid in along with her. And then one day, they saw a time-traveling ship heading through the maelstrom. It was the Fantastic Four, back in issues 337 to 341. And Nebula took control over Johnny's mind and then sues. But eventually, she was banished back to the time stream, and her and Dr. Druid ended up in some kind of alternate past. And then Druid finally freed himself from her, and then he made a stop at the hair club for men to pick up that snazzy new toupee. And then, that brings us back to the present, where Dr. Druid tells the FF that the true Kang, the one and only original Kang, is now lurking around somewhere in the 20th century. So the FF decide to check it all out, and they bring out Reed's latest time sled called Rosebud 3. And they take off, bringing Dr. Druid and Nebula, aka the Temptress, aka Ravonna, with them. So back at Avengers Mansion, the Avengers have assembled, being led by Black Widow, and the other members are Cersei, Black Knight, Hercules, and Crystal. Well, that's a killer lineup, isn't it? I mean, you know, a few of these characters have appeared in the movies. Scarlett Johansson as Black Widow, Arnold Schwarzenegger as Hercules, and Martin Lawrence as the Black Knight. So they're discussing the fact that the Vision, Captain America, and Thor have all gone missing, lost, somewhere in the vicinity of a small town in Wisconsin named Timely. I assume that story could be found in the Cap and Thor annual, but I have no interest in reading those. Black Widow says that the only thing they know about Timely, Wisconsin is that it has one main business, a 92-year-old company that manufactures exotic electrical parts. Holy shit. Is she saying that the main industry of Timely is a vibrator factory? No. She goes on to say that they make microchips, bionic subsystems, and printed circuits. Doesn't sound really all that exotic. The Timely factory was the last place that all three of the missing Avengers were last seen, so that's where they have to go. So the five of them leap around the room like idiot members of Youngblood, while Black Knight shouts out that famous catchphrase, "Avengers advance!" Okay, that one never really became all that famous. So they blast off in an Avengers Quinjet, and they head towards Timely, where the FF in Rosebud 3 are already there. Reed points out that many of the electronic components that he uses are made in Timely. That Nebula Temptress Ravonna lady points to a sign on the side of a brick wall that says, "Omega Moving and Storage." She tells Reed to fly the vehicle into that sign and assures Reed it's not really a brick wall, it's a hologram. Sue is thinking that she doesn't quite trust that woman and decides to leave a trail of invisible markers for the FF to follow on their way out. Now hold on, if they're invisible markers, how could they be followed? Surprisingly, Reed listens to the woman and flies the ship right into the wall and heads through the hologram and comes out on the other side and to a different time period where there's this big city in a glass bubble and prehistoric pterodactyls or pterodons are flying around overhead. The lady tells Reed to fly toward the Citadel in the distance, and Reed asks where they are. She says they're on the outskirts of Limbo, and the city below is part of Kang's headquarters complex. She has Reed fly the ship around through a series of time portals. Back in Timely, the Avengers arrive, and Cersei is checking the Flux Finder device to pick up strange energy readings, and she's bending over like a porn actress about to take it from behind. This is one of the few panels from the issue that I'll put up on the blog at www.podcastff.blogspot.com. So they follow these energy readings right through that hologram sign into Limbo. Back with the Fantastic Four, their ship gets caught in some kind of other ship's tractor beam, so they all jump out into the strange city below, where they soon get fired on by a bunch of people with guns. Sue puts up a force field, but Johnny flies off on his own to catch the group of locals with guns and finds they're all wearing Punisher outfits. Ben tosses a trash can at him and knocks four of them to the ground like bowling pins. Johnny melts down all their weapons and Reed rounds them up as prisoners. Next, Reed notices the Avengers Quinjet flying up above and he stretches up to say hello, but Nebula Temptress Ravonna yells out that these aren't the Avengers, they're Kang's agents in disguise. And the Avengers see the FF hanging out with Nebula, and they think they're up to no good. So the two groups start to fight, and they fight, and they fight, and they fight, page after page of awkward Liefeldian poses, everyone with their mouths wide open in every panel. Finally, Dr. Druid yells out that they should stop. The Avengers were tricked by the Temptress. I'm not sure why it took him 6 pages to say something. Maybe he was enjoying the spectacle. He was the only one. Dr. Druid says he knows where the next portal is. But before they can go anywhere, a group of muscular weirdos shows up. Very weird guys. One is like a cyborg with long blonde hair. Another one looks like Kazar or the Savage. One looks like Kang, but he's only a floating head. One dude has a sword and a long blue cape. Another one looks like a big green bird man with a sword. And there's a few other freaks. They introduce themselves as the Anachronauts. And the leader orders his men to subdue the Fantastic Four and the Avengers with all due force. And that is the end of the main story, to be continued in Avengers Annual 21, a comic I've never read, and after reading this annual, I have no interest in reading that conclusion of the story. But according to the handy-dandy internet, Reed lets the Acronauts defeat the FF and Avengers and they're taken before Kang, and then Nebula Temptress Ravonna takes a new name, calling herself Terminatrix, and she attacks Kang, and all hell breaks loose, and the Avengers and the FF defeat Kang, and they stop his plans, whatever those plans may be. The annual also has more Herb Trimpe art, So if you're a fan of shitty, shitty art, there you go. And that's that. On to the next story, which is a thing called The Top 10 Villains of the Fantastic Four by George Caragoni and Larry Alexander, which are two names that sound made up, like somebody had just finished watching an episode of Seinfeld and made up these names. So Reed is in his lab updating his computer files, and Franklin comes in and asks what he's doing. Reed ends up showing him some entries on 10 of the FF's most dastardly villains, and we see what Reed has on his computer. Surprisingly, there's only about a sentence or two on each villain. You would think Reed would have copious notes on each person, but no, the information he has on each villain is rather brief. For example, the entry on Puppet Master just says, "A brilliant biologist who uses a unique form of radioactive clay to form images and gain mental control over his victims. Also employs various automatons built by allies. Real name, Philip Masters. Status, at large. Whereabouts, unknown." And that's it. No mention of the fact that he's the stepfather of the Thing's ex-girlfriend and future girlfriend, Alicia. And not much else important either. Next up, there's the Mole Man, Psycho Man, Frightful Four. I guess it's the top 13 villains, really. Molecule Man. I wouldn't consider him a top FF villain. I wouldn't consider him a top anything. Annihilus, the Mad Thinker, the Skrulls, maybe the Super Skrull, but the entire Skrull race? Isn't that kind of racist to consider the entire race evil? There's Galactus, who Reed has argued before isn't a villain, but a force of nature. And of course, Dr. Doom. The little story ends with Reed telling Franklin that he shouldn't be afraid of any of these people. Is that really good advice? Hell, Annihilus broke into the building once and beat the shit out of little Franklin. He should definitely be afraid of Annihilus. Probably Psycho Man, too. And if he's not afraid of Psycho Man, he will be because Psycho Man will make him afraid. Galactus should come back, could come back and destroy the entire world. So yes, Franklin should be afraid of him as well. Dr. Doom doesn't seem likely that he would ever stoop to hurting Franklin. And the rest of the bunch, well, they're probably not too scary to Franklin. But yeah, Franklin should be afraid of Annihilus, Psycho Man, and Galactus for sure. So the next story is This Monster by Tom DeFalco and Kirk Jarvinen. Man, they would give just about any artist a job to fill these giant-sized annuals back in the 90s, wouldn't they? So the story starts with the Thing walking around the headquarters, and he comes across a big mirror in the hall and wonders who the hell put it there. It's not like he wants to stare at his ugly mug. Actually, now that I'm looking at it, the art by Kirk Jarvinen, whoever that is pretty good. Certainly the best art in this issue by a long shot. Next, Franklin comes running along, holding a video game which he calls the hottest new video game of all. It's titled Bad Pack Dudes. It's a Pac-Man game. Now, Pac-Man was the hottest video game of 1982, but not 1992. Franklin grabs Ben by the hand and says, "Let's go play." Ben says, "Real men don't play video games." Which really, is Tom DeFalco trying to alienate most of the young men reading this comic in 1992 by having Ben say that? They end up in the living room and Franklin hands Ben the controller. The name of the video game system is the Nincompoop, which is a terrible name for a video game system. Almost as bad as the Wii. This appears to be some kind of Super Nintendo knockoff. Ben says he can't hit those little tiny buttons with his big rocky fingers, and he starts playing anyway. So the two of them start playing Pac-Man on the Nintendo. I mean, they start playing Pac-Dudes on the Nincompoop. In this version of Pac-Man, the Pac-Men have to fight dudes with guns. The players control the men with the guns, and we see on the TV screen, Franklin's man is shooting the brains out of one of the Pac-Men. We see the blood and the brains squirting out of the Pac-Man's head. I'll put that pickup on my blog for sure. Ben, meanwhile, has his man stabbed in the chest with a large dagger by the bad Pac-Man. And then Ben tries harder to play the game, but ends up snapping the controller in half, and sadly leaves the room saying, "I guess I was right. Real men don't play video games. Monsters can't play video games." Aww. Ben walks out into the hall. He sees himself in that conveniently placed mirror again, and he smashes it. He calls himself a frog-faced freak. Frog-faced? Not like any frog I've ever seen. And he says he ain't human, and he might never be again. Franklin comes running out into the hall with a football, and says they can play catch instead. And this cheers Ben up, and they head off together. The next story is called Duel of Pride, written by Sonia Ratcliffe. Who? And more bad Liefeldian art by Herb Trimpe. And this story features those legendary FF characters, Moondragon and Mantis. Wait a minute. They're not Fantastic Four characters at all. Who wants to read about those 1970s rejects? I don't, but I'm about to. So back in the Steve Englehart run, there was a story where Mantis was trying to rescue her child from the alien race, the Kotati. And that's what she's doing in this story. Mantis, the chick with the antenna on her head, encounters Moondragon, the ball chick, and says she showed up just in time to help her rescue her child. Moondragon isn't inclined to help, and instead they fight, or they're going to fight, after Moondragon uses her powers to return Mantis to her physical body, and after that's done, they fight. So they're jumping around, kicking each other, trading punches, etc., and then Moondragon jumps up on Mantis's back and delivers something she calls the Mantis Death Grip. Shouldn't that be the Moondragon Death Grip? If you have a fucking death grip, you should name it after yourself, not the person you're using it on, right? So an hour later, Mantis wakes up from the inappropriately named, in more ways than one, death grip, and Moondragon tells Mantis that she's the most formidable antagonist she's ever faced. But she's been dreaming of defeating Mantis for a long time. I'm not even sure why these two broads were fighting. So the story ends with Moondragon agreeing to help rescue Mantis's son. And that moves us on to the last story, A Hall of Mirrors, by Peter Sanderson and Rich Yanazeski. And this story features the villain Kang and starts in his lair, surrounded by TV screens showing images of his various encounters with the FF and the Avengers over the years. There was one encounter with the Hulk, where they both traveled to World War II, and an alternate reality was created where the Hulk's grandfather was killed and the Hulk never existed, and thus the Avengers were never created. And in another incident, Kang captures the Avengers and Spider-Man while battling this other time-traveling villain Zarko, the Tomorrow Man. When Kang was eventually defeated, the Avengers were surprised to find that Kang was just an empty suit, and was just a puppet controlled from afar by the real Kang. In another encounter, Kang wanted to rape the so-called Celestial Madonna and impregnate her, but he didn't know if the Celestial Madonna was the Scarlet Witch, Mantis, or Agatha Harkness. So he kidnapped all three of them, and he was probably like, please don't let it be Agatha Harkness, please don't let it be Agatha Harkness. But before he could breed with any of them, he was attacked by the Avengers, and the Avengers had help, a guy who turned out to be an alternate version of Kang himself, Ramatut. And when Kang finally figured out that Mantis was a Celestial Madonna, Ramatut emerged from a mummy casket to stop Kang before he could rape Mantis. So then, he also planned to kill Mantis. If he can't have her, no one can. This would make a great episode of Stalker coming this fall to CBS. Kang was fighting Ramatut and was saved by another Time Lord, Immortus, and Kang regretfully accepted his help, but in the end, instead of helping Kang, he turned on him and humiliated Kang, and Immortus helped hide Mantis so Kang couldn't rape her, and she ended up leaving Earth with a new mate. In another incident, Kang ended up fighting Thor in the year 1873, and Kang tried to disintegrate Thor with a weapon, but ended up disintegrating himself instead, and he had to flee to another Kang body. And in yet another episode, Kang ended up on a planet with a bunch of superheroes and supervillains and forced by some alien being called himself the Beyonder to fight in some kind of secret war. Oh, I've heard of that one. We know that didn't end well for Kang. Actually, Kang was pretty useless in the Secret Wars. And later, back in Limbo, Kang found a dead Immortus and tried to steal all his secrets and save his ex-girlfriend Ravonna, a.k.a. Nebula, a.k.a. the Temptress, a.k.a. Terminatrix, a.k.a. the lady no one cares about. And he ended up saving her and being reunited with her, and later he formed his own Council of Kangs to oversee the multiverse, and this... Oh, shit, this is a tough story to rehash on this podcast because it's not really a story. It's like an official handbook of the Marvel Universe entry, only with pictures and bad pictures. And then Kang ended up fighting the Avengers again, and Immortus showed up, still alive, and turned out Ravonna has the hots for him. And she leaves Kang for him, and the story ends with a bitter, angry Kang saying, I have nothing left but power, and I will never surrender it, no matter what my alleged future selves claim. I am Kang the Conqueror, and from this day forth, I know only hatred. And that finally is the end of the 1992 Fantastic Four annual. Thank goodness. I have to say, this is by far the worst of the 25 annuals so far. Now, the thing I can't stress highly enough about how horrible this artwork is, I don't know how you can find a comic book artwork any worse than Herb Trimpe trying to draw like Rob Liefeld. Well, at least nothing as laughably bad. You ever heard the phrase "so bad it's good" attributed to bad movies? Well, that perfectly describes the artwork in this annual. It's bonkers. Of course, I can totally understand that it must be a real chore for the editors to fill these 64-page annuals every year with a new material, so they really had to dig deep and put anything they could find into these annuals from anyone they could find. And it doesn't get any better next year because Herb Trimpe will return in another 64-page masterpiece of crap. But we'll talk about that in another month or so. But for now, this podcast is over. Snap, crap, bush, whack.